Hello, this is Osman with House Einstein, and this is House Einstein podcast number 8, Mentors and Role Models. I'm here with Hamish Crabb.
Hello, hello.
And we're back. So, yeah. This is not a real estate specific podcast, although I'm sure we'll talk about real estate matters as we often do, but this is more of a podcast about something that's very real and present to me at this moment. I was invited to a celebration of life last week. It's actually one of the reasons the podcast is a little bit delayed. And that celebration of life was for a founder of a company I worked for when we first moved back to Colorado. And that company is now 50 years old. I happened to be in a position to interact with the founder and the CEO that replaced him quite frequently during my time at this company, and it was very formative, and it was very meaningful to attend this celebration of life, and it led me to reflect a lot on not just this particular mentor of mine, but the many that I've had in my life, and how that has led me to the creation of this company and some of the underlying principles that drive the company and, of course, the mission of House Einstein itself. And I thought it might be maybe therapeutic to talk about it a little bit, as well as perhaps helpful for those that are interested in real estate, interested maybe in working with us as their realtors, as their buying agent or their listing agent, to understand where we're coming from. And so I thought it would be a good topic, and here we are.
Doing the topic.
Yeah. We'll get into it. This particular celebration of life was for the founder of Republic Financial, which still exists in Denver, and the founder's name was Jim Pacelle, and his family still is actively involved in the company. And I was there from 2005 to the end of 2008. It was basically about 3 years. And we had recently moved back to Colorado, my now ex and I, and we had joined RE/MAX. And we came here with a certain amount of money and savings. I had previously worked in real estate. I guess really this might be a question of starting from the beginning. Since we're on a podcast, I feel like we're jumping way ahead. And there's some origin story here missing.
Some context needed.
Yeah, so we'll do the quick origin version. And maybe on another podcast, we can go really into depth on origin stories. But basically, I had been working in New York in the investment community and had felt quite burned out after about 3 years of working for an investment bank as an analyst. And this was a boutique investment bank. My role was to support the director of research, who was focused on wireline communications. I was the only associate, We had a universe, and I remember it being like 14 different companies. It was a huge universe of research coverage, and it was constant work, and constantly building financial models, updating financial models, interviewing CEOs and CFOs during their public earnings calls, or sometimes even after, which technically isn't allowed. All sorts of things were happening, and it was very interesting, and I cut my chops at that time and learned how to do financial analysis at a different level, a different scale of intensity. But one thing that really bothered me about that company were some of the conflicted ethics. And I won't name any specifics about that company or the people involved, but there were aspects of how we were doing work. And when I realized I didn't want my boss's job or my boss's boss's job, and I looked at their family relationships and the dynamics going on, I just realized that it didn't matter how much I was making, it just wasn't going to work for me. I like the skill set, I like the rigor, the ethics just bothered me deep in my core, and I just couldn't keep doing it. And then 9/11 happened. And when 9/11 happened, there was really a heavy pause, a reflection of purpose and meaning in my life. And I knew at that time, shortly after, I knew I was done. And in a roundabout way, first I moved to Boston, and I lived in Cambridge. Well, I worked in Cambridge for an environmental consulting company. I lived in Medford, you know, hung out in Somerville, that whole area of Massachusetts. That was really fun. And that period, I think, lasted about 8 months. It was sort of fall through the spring, and then I was done, and I picked up a job. So what happened was the administrations changed in Washington, D.C., and the funding dried up for this environmental consulting company. And I was doing more economics consulting, but all of their funding was tied to Fish and Wildlife and Army Corps. And when administrations go from Democrat to Republican or Republican to Democrat, guess what? They suddenly stop all contracts to review all sorts of things. And I imagine in my skepticism that you know, there's some political stuff going on there for who gets awarded contracts. But I was only a subcontractor on this project, or multiple projects, with a company called Industrial Economics in Boston. I think they're still around too. And I got the axe, so I knew I needed to find other work. I also knew I wanted to eventually come back to Boulder. I had lived here in Boulder right after finishing my MBA for a year. That company, I moved out here to start up a company. That company didn't survive, and I ended up back in New York. Did the investment banking thing, left New York, was in Boston briefly, and then the funding for this project dried up. And so I needed to come back. Well, I wanted to come back to Boulder, and that was my plan. But then on a whim, Craig Newmark, who's the founder of Craigslist, created a strange opportunity for me. And it's not the first time Craig's invention changed my life. And actually, I've emailed with him once about this a long time ago, and he was very responsive, which I felt very touched by. He probably wouldn't even recall this. It was just an email back and forth. But I applied for a job almost on a whim for working at a youth hostel on Nantucket. And within 15 minutes of lobbing in my resume and cover letter, the phone rang, and it was the guy that had just been hired as the manager of that youth hostel, and he was looking for a team. He was trying to build out a team for the summer. So I interviewed with him, and he offered me a position, and I told him I need a day or two to think about this. And he gave me that. And during that time, I called all of my board of advisors. I used to call them my silverbacks in my life, the older and experienced men and women that I really trust for their advice, that I think they've cut their chops, they've had their hardships, they've taken on mentorship roles without the official label. And I called each of them to kind of run this decision. I said to them, I really want to go to Boulder. I don't know what I'm going to do there. And, but I know that's going to be home. And I also got this job offer to go live on Nantucket for the summer and work at a youth hostel. And this job is 30 hours a week. It provides housing. It doesn't pay much. I think it was like $8 an hour or something. But housing was covered, and there's a kitchen. And my cost to commute would be zero, because I'd be living at the hostel. And I was really surprised, because I kind of expected them to say, look, Osman, that's not a professional job. You have an MBA. You've worked on Wall Street. You've worked in environmental consulting companies. You've got you're credentialed. You're experienced. You really can't work at a youth hostel, right? That's not very
totally
professional.
Against the grain. Yeah.
It doesn't climb the ladder of life, or the ladder. It actually does climb the ladder of life. It doesn't climb the ladder of what I thought at the time was professional success. But I was really surprised. To a person, each of them were like, hold on, let me understand. You have no mortgage or debt, and you have an opportunity to live at a youth hostel for the summer right across from the beach. This is a youth hostel called the Star of the Sea, by the way. You can look it up. It's since closed, and it's being redeveloped. Actually, it's on the market, I think. The entity that looked to redevelop it is reselling it, I think. I think they've paused their redevelopment plans. But anyway, I worked at this youth hostel for the summer. I got the job. I took the job. Each of them were like, why would you not take this job? That's what they said to me. That's what surprised me. Why would you not take this job? And my answers were all about what I thought professionalism was and the pathway was. So they really surprised me, and I ended up taking the job. And I moved out there without ever having been on the island of Nantucket. And I worked there that summer. And that's a whole nother podcast, maybe for another day, working there that summer, because there's a book written about that summer, which, Hamish, if you're interested, I will share with you. It's a remarkably accurate account of that summer, written by the hostel manager. Oh, and I ended up being his sort of right-hand person, his first mate, if you will. He wrote a book about that summer. And I'm in the book, which is really so kind cool. of funny. Yeah, it's very cool. Ghost stories, all sorts of things happened that summer. But I fell in love and I met this lady, fell in love, and decided I couldn't leave the island. She was committed to staying on island due to her employment situation. And I knew I wanted to move to Boulder. Actually, I had this really weird dream. And in this dream, have you ever been to Arches, Hamish?
No.
Arches National Park has just below where Edward Abbey had his he had a field station there, or a caretaker's cottage. I think it was just a trailer, but it was parked right below Balancing Rock. And I had a dream about Balancing Rock. I'd never seen it before, but I had a dream about a Balancing Rock, and I woke up with the message that Boulder can wait. And I don't know why that message was in my head when I woke up, but that's what I woke up with. And I decided, to stay on island, to stay with my now ex. And I needed to find work. So long story short, boy, this is getting long. This is not the elevator pitch version.
We're in depth, yeah.
A little bit more story than I intended to tell. So I'll try to get a little faster into this story. Initially, I worked in construction. So I literally bought a hammer. An orange safety hammer and a leather tool belt. I still own this leather tool belt. And I started cold calling construction companies because I figured this is a booming industry and they need people and there'll be somebody that will hire me. And within a week, I found a job as a roofer. And I did that for a few weeks until they fired me because they realized he's not very good on the roof. And I'm way too careful, right? I want 3 points of contact. Yeah. And we're hauling 75-pound bundles up two-story ladders, right, on your shoulder, one hand holding the bundle and the other hand holding the ladder and climbing. Nowadays, they don't do this. They use escalators off trucks. But back then, they did. And these are bundles of wooden shingles. They're not typically asphalt shingles. They're cedar shake on the island. Anyway, nice. I'm way too careful to be a roofer. And that was their conclusion. And they were right. So I told my boss one day I needed to take an extra day for a weekend, or I can't remember what it was, but I couldn't work. And when I came back, then he told me, I literally showed up at the job. He's like, sorry, you're fired. I couldn't have you not working. I needed people. But he was right to fire me, so I don't regret it. I was a little bit shocked at how callous and indifferent he was to my life stream. But maybe I handled it badly in terms of working out that time off or whatever, but he fired me. And once again, I was scrambling to find work, and I then worked in construction. I found another construction company, and this time I was hired as sort of an entry-level carpenter. And for, I think, 4 or 5 months, I worked in this role and learned a lot. I still use these skills, by the way. I still understand. I now understand how homes are constructed because I worked in construction for this period of time. And while I was working there, I interviewed. So this is 4 or 5 months in. Learned a lot. And then I interviewed for this position in community sailing. And the director of the organization realized I really wasn't a good fit for community sailing. I'm very into sailing, by the way. But that was more of an interest, not a skill set. So he interviewed me for community sailing, but he hired me to be his associate as a real estate at a real estate firm. And they were developing a private club called the Westmore Club at the time. And I helped build the original financial model and get the project funded through Lehman and handled all the requisitions for the first like 18 months of the project, which was an amazing experience. I had no previous experience doing these things, but I've always been the kind of person that just takes it on and figures it out. So I created control systems for the deposits, for the memberships. I handled the payments to the contractors. I hired the bookkeeper who worked for them for another like decade. And eventually became the controller of that organization. Nice. It was really cool. It was a great experience. And so let's talk about that mentor. And that mentor, his name is Alan Warden. And he took a chance on hiring me. And I really appreciated that opportunity. And it provided a much more stable income and bonus structure that made it much more affordable to live on Nantucket. It's an extremely expensive island. And also got my start into real estate because he had a brokerage. And he asked me to help the brokers with their opinions of value or comparative market analyses, your CMAs. When you run comps, the brokers were struggling with that sort of thing. Many of them, I sort of joked, you know, had AOL email addresses, could barely move a mouse, and really were, this was their retirement job, and they weren't into analysis. And that was that company's founding concept was that, so here's their founding concept, that people that buy homes on Nantucket typically are very affluent and successful. And they're used to a high level of professionalism from their advisors. And they've got legal advisors, tax advisors, investment advisors. But when they come to buy a multi-million dollar home on Nantucket, they're served by a mom and pop community of realtors who don't have that level of professionalism and certainly don't know anything about due diligence or want to advise on due diligence or on negotiation or really understand the market on Nantucket at the level that he really wanted to understand the market. So he hired me to, he also asked me to put together quarterly research reports. And at the time they were called the Windwalker Report. That was the name of the brokerage. I think today it's been sold and renamed something, but I would put together once a quarter a really detailed glossy page of analysis of what's happening in the market. And him and I would work on that analysis over the course of the quarter and usually up for about a month after the quarter ended, until he was happy with it, and we sent it to the professional printers. There was a designer involved, and then he would send this out to all of our clients. He would send this out to the general public. Whoever asked for it would get a copy of the Windwalker Report. And the idea was to help educate buyers and sellers and also show a different perspective on Nantucket real estate, which is billions of dollars of value, but getting no analyst coverage was how he used to say it, which was right. Like, there are companies on Wall Street that have tiny market caps, and yet there's an analyst covering it. But on this island, the real estate on this island, there's no coverage, right? There's no analytical data whatsoever. You're just dealing with people that will show you a house and just tell you how good it looks on you and tell you what a great deal it is, and you better hurry to buy it before somebody else does. And that kind of artificial pressure is how, you know, they're very salesy, not consulting, not advisory. So that was Windwalker's business model, and I worked for them for 3 years. And at the end of it, I knew I wanted to get to Boulder, right? This is where I wanted to be. And I offered to open up the Windwalker office here, actually, out of respect for Alan and his company and Nicole, who co-founded it with him. I felt like, look, I really love you guys, and it's an amazing – like, they even offered to loan me money to buy a house on Nantucket. They were really kind people and are kind people, but I knew – Nantucket wasn't going to be home for me. And so I offered to open the office here. Go ahead. You're going to ask a question.
Can I ask how you settled on Boulder? You know, like, it's been this kind of your green light, to use Gatsby as a reference, right? You've got to get there. Where'd that come from?
Yeah, it's random chance. So in my MBA program, I was good friends with, and still am good friends with, this colleague, classmate. And Brian and I, this was the booming days of the internet bubble, and we decided we wanted to start a company, and we had a good vision for that company. And that's a whole other story of what that company did, because it's not real estate related. And he had an uncle who lived here, and that uncle still lives here, actually. Brian no longer does. And we could have started that company in New York, but we decided that Boulder sounded way more interesting. And at the time, Google had just started. I remember when Google was founded, and we were using Google and other data sources that we could find to kind of, I was, to research Boulder, because I'd never been here. And I realized it's got a research university, it's got amazing weather. I grew up with John Denver, and I'm like, well, all of this sounds amazing, and it sure sounds more interesting and exciting than staying here in New York. So And that was upstate New York in Albany, not New York City. But in any event, we decided to move out here, but based on that. And when I moved out here, our company was not successful. We did our best to raise capital and found this thing, but the dot-com bubble was very rapidly falling into collapse. And even though we got in front of investors, we couldn't raise capital. And so we burned through our friends and family round really fast, and suddenly it was time to face the music. But I remembered Boulder and experienced Boulder as this magical place. I went on my first Happy Thursday cruiser ride. The weather was fantastic. The creek was beautiful. It was just really cool. It was such a cool place, and at a much smaller town in many ways than is today. I met some really cool friends. I lived with them on Rose Hill. Some of them are still really good friends, actually. I'm hosting a party this week. One of them is coming, one of my first roommate in Boulder. And I lived on 8th Street. Anyway, I loved it here, but when money ran out, I thought it was best to pick up where I left off with my MBA and get into investment banking. And then within 6 months of being in New York City, I missed Boulder so much. It took hours to get to anywhere green, anywhere interesting to go hike or camp. And I realized I'd rather flip burgers in Boulder, if that's the only job I could find, than work in investment banking in New York. And that was such an epiphany for me that Boulder is in a magical place, was a magical place, is a magical place, and felt like home, and I regretted leaving it. And so it took me years to get back here, but when I did, I've just continued to build a business and build a lifestyle and build my life, my community here.
Yeah, the rest is history, right?
Yeah, the rest
Once
is history.
Once you're back, yeah.
Yep. So Alan was a great mentor, very intellectual. I think his parents might be academics. And he adopts that sort. And he also was a refugee from New York investing world, by the way. And he asked all sorts of great questions and approached real estate from a super analytical perspective, and cared about due diligence and was focused on helping his clients make smarter decisions. And so I offered to open up Windwalker West and he declined. So we said our goodbyes. We've remained friends. I see him occasionally if I'm somewhere he is. We try to find time for a drink. It's not very common. I think I've seen him twice since I left. Although we're social media friends, Facebook friends. I hope he hears this, Alan. That's much appreciation to you for the opportunity to work for your company. And also the sort of prototype for what became House Einstein, or what has become House Einstein later. So we first moved out here. My ex at the time felt really strongly that we needed to learn Colorado contracts and learn the business model here. And she was right. We hung our license at RE/MAX. And that was probably April or May of 2005. And we did our best without any, without any network, without what social media offers today in terms of content production and broadcasting our message. We did our best to try to find clients. I put out a postcard. I built a report similar to the quarterly report for Windwalker on what's going on in Boulder real estate. I did a deep analysis. I mean, a lot of data and analysis, put it together in very visually appealing charts, printed a two or three page, I think it was a two page kind of fold out analysis of Boulder real estate, mailed out like 2,000 postcards to people to say, would you like a copy of this report? And I literally got one response, right? And meanwhile, RE/MAX is draining us because we're paying about $3,000 a month for two of us to hang our licenses at RE/MAX. They pitched us on all of the leads we might get. We got almost nothing. There was another mentor, though, at the time, and I'll mention her by name, too, who took us under her wing. So we went through RE/MAX's little training program at this office that eventually became RE/MAX Alliance. And there were a bunch of agents who were scrambling for leads. I think Chris Rattay was at the time also in that class. And Kelly Moy reached out to us with an opportunity. And Kelly is another agent here in Boulder, and she's a friend. I would also call her a mentor for the opportunity that she created. But she had set up some sort of system with a developer to create a lead generator. right? So it was a piece of software, websites that funneled contact information into a database, but the number of people that she was getting were so high that she needed help to work the leads. And so this company developed a whole system for agents to work leads, but they needed agents. And so she recruited us to be agents on her team. And the financial structure of the deal was not great, but the leads were high, and we didn't have any leads. It gave us what we needed. And so we started working those leads. And I think I closed one or maybe two of those leads in the course of however many months we were there. And it was just not sustainable. It was not profitable enough with the splits that were happening with us within the structure of what she had created. And by the fall, we were out of money. So enter the fall of 2005, and I knew that in order for my ex and I to continue to live here, we'd burned through our savings, we had racked up some credit card debt, and in order to continue to survive, I knew I had to dust off my financial acumen, beat the streets, and find work in the investment community. And I did that just like I got hired for the construction company. I did that by cold calling. I did research into which companies were worth exploring. I read the Denver Business Journal. I found a really interesting article, and the article was about the funding of some private equity deal, and it led me to this company called Republic Financial. And I, after doing enough research online, I realized, okay, I'm going to cold call them. And I called the managing director whose name was mentioned in the article. I think it was probably like a Friday night at 6 o'clock. And he was, of course, working. And he picked up the phone. And he gave me maybe 2 minutes. Like I had my pitch ready. Tom, and that's his name. He still works at Republic. Tom, who I just saw actually on Friday. Tom, my name's Osman, and I noticed this article in the Denver Post. I'm new to the community, and or not the Denver Post. I think it's the Denver Business Journal. And you know, I was really amazed. I was very interested in what you guys do for a company, and I'd love to learn more. And I think we might be a really good fit. I'm looking for a position. And I used to work in New York, and I've worked in Boston, and I've worked on Nantucket in the investment community. And I think we could actually be a really good fit. And he, you know, I could feel like the patience being really thin as the call wore out. But to my surprise, he said, okay, I'll never forget this. Send me your resume. I'm making no promises. So I sent him my resume. And the following week, I get a phone call from him, and he says that he shopped it to H. He literally walked it to HR. And they decided to go ahead and give me an interview within the capital markets group of Republic. And so I went in for this interview, and I remember interviewing with like four or five guys on the team, and the head of the group, whose name at the time, and still his name, is Dennis Lacey, and they came to the conclusion that the position they had interviewed me for was not senior enough, that they wanted me not as an analyst, but as an associate. So one thing I want to clear up, that in the investment banking research world, associates are below the analysts. But throughout the rest of the investment world, it's flipped. So analysts are junior to associates. Anyway, so they ended up creating a position for me and hired me as an associate in the capital markets group. And I was there for a few years while I was writing blog posts and working weekends. So I would work full time for them during the day, and then I would stay late at the office and work on blog posts, because I didn't want to get traffic between Denver and Boulder. This company was based in Denver, it still is, and the traffic was horrible. So if I stayed an extra hour and worked on content, my commute would go from being an hour and a half to being 45 minutes. So it was sort of a no-brainer. Stay late. And this is where I learned that not every investment company has crazy hours. Republic actually treated their people a lot more respectfully than most investment firms, and they would shut down at a reasonable time every day of the week, although some people like Tom work late and work a little harder than others. Anyway, they created a position for me. I was deeply grateful for it. I was there 3 years, and while I was there, I was writing blog posts, and I was working on the weekends on not just Republic things, but also my company's things, or my business, real estate, blog, which still exists today. It's now under the House Einstein brand, but it originated in 2005, and I continued it through my time at Republic, and some of my first clients, and now still friends, came from that real estate blog. And there are well over 1,300 pieces of content that are available, and even more than that that has been taken down. So when my ex and I split, she got the name of the old company, and so I had to remove a lot of content, but since that time, that was a long time ago, House Einstein was founded at, so let me wrap up the story with the Republic. Learned a ton. Oh my God, Hamish, I learned a ton about due diligence, about asking really intelligent questions when posed with an investment, about thoroughness, about accounting standards too, which was very interesting because we were trying to take a company public at Republic, an aircraft trading company, and there was a lot of work, a lot of interfacing with investors, a lot of interfacing with banks, also with companies. So Republic is sort of a holding company of many other companies. They've got a distressed group. They had a commercial aircraft group. They had a private equity group. And as in the capital markets group, you touched everything, which was so fascinating. And I loved working there. But by the time the global financial crisis rolled around, that company was downsizing. So Republic was going through a downsizing round of layoffs. And our little real estate practice at RE/MAX was growing. And I realized that we were right at the point where we could afford for me to quit this job and work full-time in real estate. So after discussions with my now ex, we agreed to do that. So I asked the CEO for a layoff. I said, look, it's really clear we're in financial trouble. And I knew this because I could see the numbers, yeah. Right? We worked in the capital markets group. And I told him, I could see what's happening. And if you're going to have another round of layoffs, you can lay me off. My wife and I have got this side thing going on. It's going fine. And we can probably survive just fine. And there's other people within this company that cannot. Right. They are at way higher risk. They don't have any backup plan at all. And we're okay. And so he said it to me, well, that's very nice of you, Osman, but there's no chance we're having another round of layoffs. We just had the first layoff we've ever had in 40 years of history, 35 years, I think the company was that old. We're not this having another Jim. One. No, this is Randy, who's the CEO. Okay. Jim was partially retired at that point. He was still attending the high-level meetings, but he wasn't dealing with operations. And within a week, I got a knock on the door from the head of HR that says, okay, we are having another round, and we're going to lay you off. And I was like, oh, okay, so I'm so sorry to hear that. And I'll never forget, so this is where I screwed up. I did not tell my boss I was doing this. Dennis. Dennis was not happy with me because he was not going to lay me off. I was doing so much work for him. Yeah. He was going to fight for me. There was zero chance I was getting laid off. And so anyway, I got laid off, and that allowed me the flexibility to launch what became Silver Fern, my previous real estate company in 2007 that was founded. 2008, I think, is when I can't remember exactly these dates, but Silver Fern grew to a point where it was sustainable and comfortable. My ex and I split. There's a whole story there that's not podcast friendly. And she got that old company. And in 2013, when we split, I created House Einstein. And House Einstein is now coming up on a decade of sustainability. It is profitable. I hope it's well run. We're doing our best. And our mission is all about helping people make smart decisions. But if it wasn't for the Alan Wardens and the Jim Pascells, who founded Republic on a $500 credit card charge, he had no money, 50 years ago, who hired and trained Randy, or at least help him grow up in the professional world to become the CEO, I wouldn't have had the skills, experience, or even the money to buy my first house. Because if it wasn't for Republic. So at this celebration of life, got to experience the family members talk about Jim and his ethics and his integrity and his values. Got to hear Randy talk about Jim. And it was very moving. And I realized at that time that a lot of the things I've learned in really good ways from these mentors, like Jim was not as direct, like he was in the meetings asking the questions, but if it wasn't for his influence, you know, companies tend to take a reflection of their founders, at least while they're, you know, alive. They may change after that, but when they're alive, they tend to have a lot of the ethos of who created the company, and that's what Republic was. And I'm deeply grateful for, you know, that amazing opportunity that the company took on me. I'm deeply grateful for Tom, who picked up the phone late on a Friday night and listened to a cold call pitch and thought enough of it to walk my resume to HR. And with a foreign sounding name and a resume that is sort of checkered, right? A lot of HR professionals are not going to would not have put my resume at the top of the basket because it doesn't match the story for what they think the successful candidate should be. Plus, and I'm not trying to say the world is racist, but look, it's not an advantage to have a name that people can't pronounce.
No, there's statistical like evidence on that one now.
Yeah. I mean, my name is not even Osman. I'm saying it for your listening pleasure, Hamish. That's not what my mom calls me.
You'll have to tell me.
But, well, I mean, I'll share it. Maybe we'll talk about it more at another time. But the correct way to pronounce my name is Usman. Usman is how you say my name. Usman or Usman. And it's a name that's very common in Turkey. It's less common in India and Pakistan, where my family is originating from, from Punjab. And my born in 1975 in New York, my parents didn't really care that this name is going to be hard for Americans. But unfortunately, the name is like the sounds are not common in American English, and so people struggle with it. I can say it to them, we could practice it together, but within 2 minutes, they're screwing it up. And this was my experience throughout childhood, and I realized we'll just stick with what people can pronounce, which is what they say when they read my name. And so Osman has become my identity, has become my personality, is who I am. Well, I mean, names are not really who you are, unless you've chosen them. That's another topic. But names that you're given, I don't think really reflect your core identity anyway. But Osman is very easy to say. So Osman it has been since about kindergarten.
And people still get it wrong.
Yeah, and people say that I don't hold it against them. It's not an easy name to say. And certainly when you're applying for a job and they can't pronounce your name, unfortunately there's implicit bias, and that's going to make it harder for you. And it was harder for me, so I had to adopt more aggressive strategies like cold calling, and that worked. I mean, my hit rate cold calling, Hamish, was like over 50%. When I chose to employ that tactic to find work. My hit rate sending in resumes in New York, Boston, and otherwise, less than 1%. 100 resumes, maybe I'd get a phone call. In fact, the job in Boston also was a cold call. Was not a I cold called and sweet-talked an HR person into interviewing me.
Well, noted.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the reasons why it's important to talk to people. It's also important to monitor your biases, but that's a whole other topic. It's really hard to do implicit bias consciously. Monitor that. So that's sort of a few of my big mentorships, and continue to have some, right? Some of my best clients have taught me so much about historic homes over long working relationships that they too have been mentors, and I'm deeply grateful for all of them. But Jim and Republic, I felt was a really good kickoff to, the founding ideas that drive what we do, which is help people make smarter decisions. Don't sell them, advise them. They make the decisions. We don't make the calls. They do, but we provide them the best information we can, and preferably with data to back it up, not because it feels that way, but because we can show you the data that confirms this to be the case. And there you have it. So that's my mentorship journey.
Yeah, that is a journey and a half. Let's say you have a few years on me. So, you know, the whole time you're talking about this, I'm thinking back on kind of mentorship and how I've looked at it. And for me, it's been less defining, and perhaps you've had the time to look back onto it and really notice, and you know, hindsight's 20/20. You can really understand who's a mentor and who's not in your life. I think I've had probably a few at this point, and I don't necessarily want to go into too much detail, because, you know, it's praised by name and then criticized by the larger thing, though at the same time, there have been people in my life that have not only given me a tremendous amount of opportunities, but also have led by extreme example. One of the larger lessons I've learned through mentorship has been independence and that kind of self-start mentality, where it's you really have to act on something if you want it to begin. You can't kind of wait around for the moment. It comes from within. And then learning how to correctly implement your ideas and how to act upon your I don't want to say desires, more or less your dreams or your plan or your vision, and making the correct next step. My grandfather, it was a huge influence on that respect, because he had such a unique life story. You know, he's super... He's a boomer, so especially like back in that.
That's not a bad thing, Hamish.
No,
I know that
no,
millennials want to throw the boomers under the bus.
No, this is for boomers. Context.
Okay.
So he was a boomer. He had like his first child when he was 21 and in college, in the School of Mines. And so hearing that kind of life story of how he navigated the challenges of raising a child while also going to school and then trying to end up in a decent career, it was really interesting. He ended up dropping out of Mines.
This is the child is your mom we're talking about?
Yeah, she was okay. The first. So he ended up dropping out of Mines, somehow still stayed in, he was going in there for geology, and somehow stayed in that industry for a decent amount and jumped around jobs with like Rocky Mountain Energy and a few other the larger utility companies and rail companies, Rocky Mountain Energy and then Union Pacific. And eventually he ended up with like charisma and also just a lot of the things that I learned from him was how to talk to people. And he ended up as a lobbyist. And so there is a lot of that sort of traits that I learned from him. And he dispelled a lot of the nerves you would typically have if you're speaking to somebody of a higher caliber than you, and kind of all the fear that comes with putting yourself out there. You know, he'd tell me regularly that he's got pieces of legislation that he wrote that are still in law today in California, you know. And I don't know if that's, yeah, that can be public, I guess. So he was a huge impact, and just always really taught me kind of where to start out and how to negotiate different life paths. I called him before I picked up, before I really set my eyes on House Einstein. You know, I wanted to check it out with him, and we talked out for, I think, like an hour and a half before I put the offer in on the house last week. That didn't get accepted, by the way. I gave him a call. You know, I was like, hey, I'm about to do this. Where do we stand? So it's nice just having somebody to kind of go back to.
I mean, there's people that have had challenging lives and principled lives, disciplined lives, and have learned a lot, and they actually really love sharing that with others and helping others be successful in life. There are people whose life reflects that ethic and those values. They don't have to tell you they believe those things. They act in ways that are in line with those beliefs. And so family like your grandfather that are willing to take the time to help guide the next generation are all part of that ecosystem. And at some point, if you're not already, I'm sure you are in your friends group, like offering support and advice and guidance. It starts at an early age, and it's really by example, not by somebody telling. In fact, the more they tell you how much they have in terms of integrity and values, likely the less true it is.
it's really that, you know. It's people, you know, tell me about yourself. It's like, well, people have a hard time defining themselves. It's what you do is who you are. So if you're not acting as you would want to be, then how are you going to tell people who you are, right?
Yeah. No, absolutely. When I was growing up, I remember going on house calls with my dad. So my dad is a doctor. He's now retired or semi-retired. And when I was growing up, like, it was something that I grew up with, was if I wanted to spend time with him, it was time to go drive with him to a person's house, and he'd have me wait in the car. And then when I was a teenager in middle school, he had me work at his office. So like our new intern we brought on today, whose first day is today, I worked at my dad's office as one of my first jobs, and I mowed lawns, and I brought in patients, which is probably not what I should have been doing, but he had me meet the patient in the waiting room, weigh them, and then walk them into the examination room and leave the chart there. And my job was sort of meet and greet. The nurses were busy. It was a private practice. And he was slammed. And this was just the way I could support the family. And I guess probably from his perspective, he'd keep an eye on me too. But I remember sometimes, so he would come out from the patient and with the patient and go to the receptionist and indicate to the receptionist what the charges would be. And this is, you know, before the era of managed care, but there was still health insurance and that sort of stuff. But I remember the, you know, the examination fees being really reasonable, typically like $40 or $60 or whatever. And every once in a while, and it was sometimes like two or three times a week, he would just say no charge. And after, you know, I worked there for a while, I finally asked him, I got up the nerve. My dad can be a little intimidating. I got up the nerve to ask him, why are you not charging these people? And he just said, they can't afford it. And it wasn't even like, there was no long discussion about this. He's just mm-hmm. like, they can't afford it. And so he routinely just gave people free care when their economic circumstances dictated by his judge and jury perspective, right? He made the decision. This wasn't some social program that they just couldn't afford it. And so he would, out of kindness, just treat them to free medical advice. And I don't know, that at the time it struck me. I mean, here I am, like, you know, 35 years later, and I still remember that. And so those types of direct experiences underlie the kind of foundation of one's principles and ethics and values in life. And it's not that mistakes don't happen, right? As you know, I keep a whole list of. So one of my other, I don't want to call him a hero, but somebody I admire a lot, who came from a middle class background and founded the largest private equity firm, the largest hedge fund, I think is what they call themselves, Bridgewater. I really have enjoyed reading his books, Ray Dalio's books on principles. The World Order books are a little intense and a little bit too analytical, but the Principles book, and it's not that those books aren't good, they're good, that's a whole nother topic, but the Principles books really shook me up a little bit. Both the business principles and the personal principles that that's how he divided up that book, that really impacted me. And after reading that book, I started writing down my own. So I keep a list of principles that I keep working on, a code of ethics that I hold myself to, and I look at it pretty frequently. It's definitely not an everyday thing, but it's 100% like a reflection of all of these mentors in life, teachers, educators of all kinds. Maybe they wrote a book that impacted thousands or millions, or maybe it was direct experience working with them and watching their behavior, from family members to first bosses to coworkers. It creates this kind of pathway to how one thinks about the world and how one decides they want to operate. And I knew I'm not going to operate in New York, where at an investment bank where money was the most important value, period, and they would sell their souls and family members to make a buck without a problem, without hesitation. And that just was so egregious. And then the power game also that was going on that I saw between some of the top people and others down the food chain, I just found just distasteful. Like, there was something that rubbed me so wrong. And after learning the systems and learning the financial analysis game, feeling like I'd, you know, when the job got easy, I got a little bored and I got a little disgusted. Yeah. And then 9/11 happened. And it was like, that's enough.
I mean, you got past learning the job, right? So you're able to complete it and then look around. And once you looked around, you were like, you know, not my crowd.
Right. Not really my crowd. And it's okay. They do what they do. And I still met amazing people, and I'm still friends with some people from those days. But I also know that that particular company, I was not a good fit for. What they were driven to do and how they did things was not how I wanted to be in the world. And it took me a while. So I took a huge hit to my income leaving Wall Street. And it took me about a decade to make the same amount of money that I did in my 20s. And it was through Republic. It was through the trust of the company that Jim Pascal created that I was able to buy my first house. It was because of the environment that allowed me a reasonable work schedule that I had time for a side project at night and on the weekends. And that side project, they didn't take offense to. In fact, when I was at Jim's Celebration of Life, one of the things that Randy mentioned to me actually mentioned to the whole room was just how proud he was of all of the employees of that company that have gone on to create their own companies. Wow. Like, that's huge. That's somebody that wants others to be successful, not just keep all of the pie to themselves. Like, is actively celebrating the success of other people after they've left the mothership without any financial interest, right? Like, they didn't invest. They didn't ask me to pay back anything. They were just really supportive. And when I told Randy, I've got, you know, this other thing going on that my ex is running that we can support ourselves on, he was like, okay, go for it. And when I told him I'm still doing that, because they had no idea when I saw him, he was just like, I am so happy for you.
That's amazing.
And when Dennis tried to hire me, like, a few years after leaving Republic, and I told him what I'm up to and how I'm working and the income I'm making, because he tried to hire me for his investment. He was starting an investment fund, something to do with real estate. I can't remember exactly. But he saw that I was in real estate and also that I had worked really well for him. He tried to hire me back. And when I told him no, he agreed. He's like, what you're doing is way, way higher level than what I can offer you. And so ever since, it's been real estate. And Republic was a foundation stone in my personal professional upbringing. And I'm grateful for the people that created that company and the family members that are still part of that company, and for Tom for taking a chance on some random cold caller with a strange sounding name.
I'll say, I was actually thinking of something similar today. You know, it's, people are happy to be mentors or to support somebody. I don't necessarily want to say underneath to create that visual, but somebody maybe starting out or at a lower level. And it's interesting because I've noticed a trait where people, they're happy to do that, but the moment whoever they're helping or whoever they're coaching begins to get on their level or start to surpass, that's when the jealousy comes in. And so it really defines a good mentor or a good person when there's nothing but joy and happiness for whoever they're coaching, even, you know, as they grow larger or as they do more than that mentor ever could.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I agree. And that really is a pivot point. When the Padawan is exceeding the master, when the senpai, the kohai and senpai relationship in Japanese culture, I can never remember which one's the senior and which one's the junior. But
I think kohai is senior.
Yeah, I think kohai is senior too. When the senpai is reaching mastery level, a true kohai should be supportive, yeah, and want them to achieve far greater success than they have achieved. That to me is true. I don't know, mentorship, when you're not threatened by your juniors on your team. And so that's sort of where I'm at with House Einstein. It's actually, you know, the thought process for our new intern, Grant, was that, okay, can we offer him something of substance and value? We're not going to ask him to do it for free. I got to pay him something because I don't believe in free internships. That's just, you know, economic slavery and taking advantage of somebody that wants experience. But I'm also going to look for him adding real value. It's not going to be go fetch the coffee, which is value, but not the kind of value that is professional. Like, he should get 50% or greater exposure to professional tasks that improve his skill set, improve his resume, open doors for him. And, you know, as much as 50% could be administrative randomness. And in real estate, there's a lot of randomness, at least in the residential real estate. So how are we doing on time, Hamish?
Osman, we're hitting 53 minutes.
Okay. Well, we could wrap it. We could talk a little bit more. What are your thoughts?
I think one note that would be maybe interesting to hit would be, if you were kind of just a thought experiment or maybe a takeaway on what you're doing is, if you have a mentee or you have a mentor, imagine the roles reversed and what you would ask from yourself and kind of how would you prefer things to be explained or how would you expect the conversation to go. A lot of mentorships, at least that I would say that I've had, you know, not defined mentorships, there's a lot of hinting and it's a pretty indirect conversation. So when you're looking at that and having that conversation with yourself, is there things that could be said that would make it more of a clear answer. And when you're picking traits or when you're looking at your hero, how would you decide which traits are best, and how does that align with not only your own ethics, but is it going to change the way you act in the future? You know, maybe being in direct exposure to somebody who's an excellent business owner but a terrible person, you know, is that something you can handle as a mentee? You know, just kind of exploring the dynamic of that.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. And I felt like in several of my professional work roles and non-professional work roles, they were also opportunities to learn from bad bosses and bad work experiences. And processing these experiences during and afterward led me to a perspective of what did I learn from other people's mistakes. I didn't need to disclose that I didn't have respect for this particular boss or this particular company or other. You keep that to yourself, right? Like they've given you a job and they're paying you. And even if they're a bad company, there's things to learn from it. So personally, I feel like the right attitude is always one of learning. What can you learn from this experience, and how do you apply it so it doesn't happen again? And how do you, so I've seen even the companies I've mentioned today, I've saw them make mistakes. Mm-hmm. All people and companies make mistakes, and you're being paid to get a seat at the table in the controls of the ship to see what they do or they're doing right and what they're doing wrong. And it may not be your place to say what they're doing wrong. Your opinion may not be valued, and if it's not, then you might not want to share it. But in many regards, I feel like a junior that is truly invested in the team has a responsibility to say what's going wrong. And if you have a trusted relationship with your mentor or your boss or the senior person in the company, you should feel like your opinion matters and you should feel safe in sharing that. How you share that might need to be carefully, judiciously applied, like not in front of other people. You may want to take them aside and say, hey, boss, can I have a conversation with you? I don't really believe in what we're doing and I'm struggling with that. And you should feel safe enough in the relationship container with this person to be able to share that. And if you don't feel safe enough in this relationship, well, maybe it's the wrong relationship. But it's really on you to create that dynamic or seek it. I personally have not been able to be forthright with some of my bosses when I was much younger because I just felt like they didn't have my interests in mind. I was just a cog in the grand machine of what they were trying to create. And then there are others that I felt like, all right, clearly are taking an active and interest in my professional growth and development and care. And not because they were told to be a mentor, not because they get some discount for being a mentor at the lunch counter, not because they get a gold star in their employment report for being an official mentor, but because they actually want to be a mentor. They're aligned with that. They want to help the next generation be successful. They know that builds their community and supports the overall ecosystem. It's in line with what they believe. And there was just a feeling, right, with certain of my bosses that I've mentioned today, that I could be open and honest and candid about where things were and things I was struggling with. And I certainly hope to try to create that relationship in our team and within our company. And I've been told I'm not that easy to approach, right? Like, it's not that easy to say something. Maybe I come across as not warm enough and too businesslike sometimes. But, you know, I'm doing what I can. And at the same time, sometimes you got to make decisions, and they're hard decisions. A mentor is not here to tell you what you think.
No.
Right? They're not here to tell you what you want to hear. They're here to guide you in the direction, hopefully, of your best interest for the future. And that can be painful to hear sometimes.
On both sides.
On both sides. And sometimes it's just not a good relationship. And in which case, if it's not a good relationship, it's probably better to end it sooner and find a company that you have alignment with. Sometimes you got to work in a crappy job for a few years to value a good one. And what I've seen is people are willing to really put their lives on the line when they believe in the mission, when they feel supported in their roles, when they're treated like a human being, they're paid fairly. All of these things matter. And if you put those things together, you get amazing people on the team.
Yeah. Takes two to tango, right?
Well, everyone's responsible, in my opinion, responsible for their Yeah, it takes a village, or it takes more than one to tango, but it also is a question of who's responsible for the creating the mentorship-mentee relationship, and it's both, mm-hmm. right? If it's something that requires integrity and effort and focus to achieve. And it may not happen in the company that anybody is particularly with. It may happen in the next one, but I think it's magical when it works right.
Oh, yeah.
When it works well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes a very strong dynamic. Well, I'm mostly complete on this. I really liked the notes we hit today.
Yeah, me too. I think we covered a lot. And I do want to make it clear of how much gratitude I have for all the mentors I've mentioned today.
Same here.
The opportunities that have been created for me. Family members that set examples, as well as professional mentorships, academics. I didn't talk about teachers, and there have been many, many teachers that had massive impact on my life, and I'm just deeply grateful. But for interest of time, I think the point has been made on mentors and role models.
Had we had that point down before we started, I could have hindsight.
Well, is there anybody you want to mention right now?
I'll bring him up just because he still sits with me today, and it's interesting because I think of it in a playful context. But I had this teacher, Mr. Kirkland, in elementary school, and like I still talk to him occasionally today. And he, for whatever reason, my mom didn't really like him, and my brother had him, and they didn't really get along. But I thought it was a huge joke, so I ended up having him for one of my school years. And I liked him a lot. I thought he was like just a genuinely cool person. But I remember we were writing poems or something, and we had to put a border around the page. And I handed it in knowing that it was sloppy. And he was like, "What is this?" And I was like, it's the work you asked for. And he goes, "Aren't you gonna have pride in anything you do?" And like since then I've just been like, okay, pride, okay, fine, you know. And like that's actually just been huge. I've been thinking about like the pride in the work that I do since then, and whether or not, if I'm turning something in, is it worth the pride, or is it should I want to have pride? And it's just been big.
So. Do you feel proud of the work you did today? Do you feel did it meet at your expectations, or have you performed something kind of half-assed work? Even as a border and a drawing, I like it. That's somebody calling you to be your best.
I think it was something along the lines of like, can't you just show pride in your work just once or something? Because I think I was just always like, you know, fulfilling the bare minimum and calling it good, and I think he was tired of it, but
Yeah, we don't fulfill the bare minimum, at least here in this company. And I'm glad that he was there for you to help you realize that.
Yeah.
Bringing it back to real estate, just to wrap up, we don't market that we do affordable housing, and so we do. And sometimes the affordable housing deals take up 2 to 3 times the cognitive effort and to work to get to the finish line as an average deal, and they still, you know, they get that workload. They get that level of attention to detail. They get that care, that due diligence that all of our clients get, whether they're buying affordable housing or high-end properties here in Boulder. And it's because I don't want to do anything in my life that is half-assed, mm-hmm. that meets the bare minimum. And it's sort of, what's the joy in that? Why not push the boundary? Why not constantly be improving instead of meets the standard as the goal?
100%.
Meets the standard is like, okay, well,
you don't
congrats.
Get a gold star that way.
You don't
star
get a gold
star. Motivation here.
although sometimes meets the standards is all you can do, right? Like maybe that's not your skill, maybe it's not your thing, and whatever you've been asked to do, meeting the standard, it might be enough. That's fine. If that's all you can do, I just feel like putting in your best is what's important, and that's what we're all about.
I think to drag it out here, speaking to our ethics and the way we do things, if we weren't doing affordable housing, how could we say we really want to help people make a smarter real estate decision? Like we are hitting every base and doing everything we can because we genuinely care about what we're doing than just the return on it. We're putting, you know, action where we speak.
You know, I appreciate that. And yeah. If there are places, and you know, I'll say this to you publicly. If there are places you feel like we are not acting in line with our integrity, I really need you to call it out. And I need you to, if you feel intimidated by me as the boss, I need you to get over it and call it out, because I don't want to live a life that's not in line with my conscious beliefs and values. And the only way to have that as an organization is to have enough trust in each other, enough transparency to, and enough safety to know that you can say things like that, carefully reflected on. You know, it's not, you gotta choose your moments, you gotta
flame.
When to cash in your chips, all those things, because it takes a long time to earn trust, it takes a long time to earn a reputation. It's very easy to destroy those things. So, you know, it's always important to be judicious in the moments and how you communicate, especially something around integrity, because people get very defensive. I'm sure I would if you came out of the blue and smacked with me with something. I probably would initially react with some defensiveness. I'd want to have some separation. I'd want to pause and not say anything, cool down. But when people are triggered, sometimes they say things they later regret. Oh, yeah. And integrity, having my integrity question is something that does trigger me. I will admit that.
I'll say again, speaks to, you know, character. When your integrity is questioned, of course you'll be upset because you take that seriously. So,
I'm doing the best I can, and I think we're all doing the best we can. I'm not claiming to have some incredibly high level above all else. I'm just doing the best I can. All right, well, that's it for this House Einstein podcast number 8. I think it's time to wrap it. If you are looking for us, you can find us at houseeinstein.com. We've got a newsletter that we do put out. It's a little bit delayed at the moment because other things are on our radar. Clients come first. This podcast takes about an hour or so to record and maybe another hour of Hamish's time to publish it, but the newsletter is much more labor intensive and much more challenging to put out on a regular basis, but we are still putting out the newsletter, and I do appreciate all the people that have offered comments that are listening to the podcast or our other content. And especially I'm deeply grateful for all our clients, and thank you, Hamish, for making time today to be on the podcast, and we'll see everyone next time.
Alrighty. Thank you.
All right.